We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boscovich.
What's happening, everyone? This is The Pause Button Paranormies Crossover. I am your host, Borzoi, and with me, co-hosting as well as its half-ish show too, Johnny Monoxide.
Say hello, Johnny. What's happening, everybody?
Oh, there we go. That's right. We do have a little bit of a delay. And also, special guests joining us on, because you can't have a spoopy episode with the spoopiest of the spoops. It's Hoob, Mitch Hoob.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, all right. This is kind of exciting. I've never done your show, Johnny, but I have to remember, I've done several episodes, as I recall. I just seem to keep forgetting that I do that. And you, of course, you've been on before. People should check out the Mina Connection Conspiracy of Silence episode we did last year, which was very good. But on that theme,
yeah, that was a really good one. And of course, don't forget with Surgeon General McNabb, we did the second part of the Matrix trilogy.
That's right. And that was a big one. That was me, you, McNabb, and Miles Poland, as I recall. I believe he was on that as well.
Yeah. Yes, that was good. A lot of fun.
But again, if you're on, then we must be talking about something conspiratorial, and we are. We are talking about the documentary that came out last month, Out of Shadows. It was actually, Hoob, do you want to introduce this? Because you were the one who told me about this.
Yeah, you know, what happened was I keep a close ear to Schizo Twitter, and I kept seeing them post this and bragging about being blocked by John Podesta for posting it. And I was like, okay, guys, let's see what this is all about. I went and checked it out. And of course, I'd also heard about it through some people I know in my regular life that had heard about it through their financial advisor of all people. So I'm thinking, okay, if it's starting to work through the normie schizo train like that, I'm going to have to check this out. I did. The first half hour or so, I was like, okay, I guess, you know, this is nothing too unique.
It's a little bit weird as well, because you're wondering, like, what am I watching exactly here? Like, you got a guy talking to his physical therapist about demons and such. It's like, okay, what exactly am I watching here?
Yeah, but it's at that point that it really starts to take off.
What are you going to say? Sorry, because Johnny's got a delay, so I want to see if he wants to say something like that. Kind of want to let him hop in. What are you going to say, Johnny?
Yeah, sorry about the delay, guys. I'm on that really, really far out in the woods internet. Same when I first watched it, you know, I'm the conspiracy guy, so like I like this kind of stuff. And watching this guy, I'm like, okay, this looks like a really well produced documentary. This guy seems like he's well spoken. He knows what he's doing. He's a big name in his field, but I don't really know what's going on. And you know, it didn't seem too. I wasn't sure what all the hype was about until, like you said, Hubert. Like, it got interesting right about where you said.
Yeah, at about a half hour, 40 minutes, I noticed that what they were doing was really just like slowly building a case, and you know, holding the viewer's hand and kind of guiding them along this road of deeper and deeper conspiracy stuff. And I was just totally blown away with that, because it gets into a lot of places that most things don't.
Yeah.
And it didn't go super deep, but it really covered a lot of bases.
And we haven't really explained what conspiracy they're talking about here, or rather conspiracies, because as you said, this documentary covers a number of different fronts. It's ostensibly explaining the whole Pizzagate stuff, but they connect it to a number of different things. And they, as you said, Hoob, they kind of spin this very, like the way they build upon it and explain it and build towards it, it works well. I know, Johnny, you watched it with your wife. I watched it with somebody else who had completely missed, they were not plugged into the 2016 election. And so all this stuff was completely new to them, and they were shocked at what they saw and how much of that was verifiable if you just looked into it yourself.
Yeah, I had to sit there and, well, first of all, I've already ruined Disney for my wife. She was a large Disney fan. You know, we used to love to go to Disney. My son loves Disney. Well, now that we know what's going on with Disney, we can't like Disney anymore, and that hurts her feelings. And then seeing this, it just doubly reinforces all that stuff, and it just, you know, and it still makes her angry, some of the stuff, because, you know, these are supposed to be our entertainers, our celebrities, the people we celebrate. You know, these are the people our kids watch, and you know, they act out the movies and this kind of stuff, you know, and they watch the Disney movies 1,000 times. And and it's just all really bad stuff. Bad stuff.
Yeah, and if I were to describe, I guess, exactly what this is about, it's just showing you how much your media is just like, it is a tool, it is a weapon that is used against you, and the intersection it has with corporate and state power in terms of, and you know, and the evil people behind the scenes and the evil things that they do with that, with this weapon. So that's really essentially what Out of Shadows is about. It's funny because it's a short documentary, but it's almost hard to explain on some level in a short way because it packs so much into it all. Like, and they do a good job of spacing it out, but man, it is a dense documentary.
There's at least 12 separate yet related conspiracies that they dive into in this.
Yeah, because I'm looking at my notes. If I were to show somebody my notes on this, they'd be like, what were you? Were you just like reading some kind of schizophrenic Twitter thread? What is all this?
Yeah, and the other thing that I really liked about it is they give you the man's name that starts it out, the original narrator is Brad Martin, and he kind of also relates that he thought nothing of any of this stuff. It was all like totally bizarre. He always thought, well, who has the time to even look into that sort of thing? And then eventually he just starts to relate how he got pulled into it, what started to make him notice, and it just builds from there.
What were you gonna say, Johnny?
Yeah, I was gonna say, these guys. Like you said, the narrator. He's just a stuntman, right? You know, he's just a, you know, he worked his way up to being like a stunt coordinator, fight coordinator, or whatever. The other guy, the same thing. And they were both had seen all this stuff that nobody really paid attention to. And I suppose that's the way it is with a lot of people around Hollywood. It has to be. They just see it and they just assume it's whatever. It's none of their business or what. I don't know. Is it, you know, just doing my job and just getting paid? Or are some of them actually complicit, you know, because you see a lot of that around Hollywood anyway. I forgot what I was going to say. I totally lost my track. Oh, the stuff that got me was like how they called it the military entertainment industrial complex.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. It really is a weird thing to basically think about. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's part of the government. Like, yeah, there are entertainment in government propaganda, literally.
Well, when you think about it, it's a really weird thing to consider because you have this industry, this massive, massive industry that employs hundreds of thousands, if probably not a million people, when you consider all the constituent parts that it has. But, and it's also this intersection for corporations. It's an intersection for the government. I mean, you don't even have to be conspiratorial. Like, just look at the fact that the amount of military movies that were made during wartime for the government, without getting into the more shadier connections, which are easy to verify as well. This has always been there. So you have this intersection, and then you have people that are constantly scrambling for clout, status, power, in all of that. And it's in our culture, it's treated as this benign thing. It's like, oh well, this is just the movie industry. That's all they do, is they make movies to entertain us, and as though they do nothing else, and that nobody else would attempt to use that in any way possible.
And the other thing, though, too, is that, like, everybody knows they jam these messages in. And, like, just 3 days ago, the headline, Ted Cruz pushes bill to stop Hollywood from censoring movies for China, says he will introduce a bill cut off Defense Department assistance for Hollywood. Like, wait, what?
And guess, get in his assistant, what's her name? Cinema?
The Arizona Center?
Cinema, what's her name? From Arizona?
Kristen Cinema.
Yeah, Cinema. Kristen Cinema is the co-sponsor. I think that's freaking hilarious. Cinema is going to try and censor the cinema industry. Come on.
Yeah, they're putting it right in our faces.
Well, it's... Yes. I guess
it's literally, like I keep saying, they rub it in our face.
I mean, this is something we've been talking about a lot more lately, is how media is a tool to make you mentally ill. But, like, the other way to think of it, of course, is that media is a weapon. I mean, we talk about propaganda, but it's not just because it's delivering certain messages. It's because of the way that these messages are framed, but it's also because of our relationship to the technology of the image and the things that it does to that animal part of our brain. I mean, it really does cause people to just, like, kind of fracture their brains in a certain sense. And it's weird. Like, it's funny when you understand that and you step back and you look at this, and even though people know Hollywood is full of corrupt, evil people, they have this dissonance that forms where it's like, well, they're the movie makers. They don't see anything insidious about the very nature of film media itself, even though that's how it's used, that's how it's treated, that's how it's weaponized. It's an incredible thing. It's like that they have managed to create a national cognitive dissonance across people.
Yeah, and it's been perfected in soon to be 8K. You know, it was 4K up until recently. This is ridiculous at how the messages. That was the thing that the narrator. Was the narrator, your first narrator, Brad Martin, or what was the other guy's name? Mike Smith. Yeah. That's the main guy. Yeah, Brad Martin's the one with the semi-French accent. Yeah. Well, that's what Mike Smith was saying, is that he started noticing that all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but he just started noticing that there's narratives. There's, these feminist narratives, these, women's of color narratives, all these narratives he's noticing more and more and more, and that the movie is more about the narrative than the movie itself. Just a bunch of special effects with the SJW narrative.
Yeah, and he's specifically mentioning that they're putting what seems to him to be a foreign morality onto children and observers in general.
Yeah.
Foreign meaning not Christian.
Yeah. And the interesting thing as well is that he was only able to get into this because he suffered pretty much a career-ending injury, which, after being in that scene for such a long time and meeting all these people and knowing these people and being kind of marinating in that culture, now he's being forced out because he can't work for them for the most part anymore. So now he's able to take a step back and look from the outside in as a, this is what I've been involved in my whole life. Like, what is it? One of the most interesting subtle parts of this documentary is like how he's forced to reevaluate what he's been doing. It's like, like the guy who, you went and got a factory job and it's this big patriotic business. And then after you have an injury and you step out, he's like, wait a minute, I've been working in a weapons factory my whole life. What the hell?
Yeah, exactly. Or like taking a break from Twitter for 4 months and coming back on and saying, wait, was it always this way?
Yeah, it's disorienting. It's extremely, extremely disorienting. And that's there's and actually some of the stuff that this documentary gets into is actually quite interesting because of some of the stuff like I know we rolled our eyes at, like the Operation Paperclip stuff. Like there's this documentary is not without some of its flaws, but this documentary actually maybe caused me to reevaluate a couple of things as well. But I don't know if we want to kind of work our way towards that. If we want to go chronologically through our notes. Go ahead, Hoob.
Well, I would say, it just like, the real boilerplate issue that it starts off with is just how all of these media conglomerates are connected. There are so few owners, which we're all abundantly familiar with. And it takes a little bit of time explaining how media and government, all these things are tied together with, certain people being married to each other across like ABC to State Department and all that. And these things just naturally, seemingly naturally intertwine, but that it's all just one big club.
You know what, since we're kind of talking about this conglomeration of media, and one example you brought up, Johnny, with your wife was the truth about Disney. There's a book people should check out called The Trojan Mouse, How Disney is Winning the Culture War by a Sam Lively, where he goes into basically the culture-wrecking power that Disney now has and how it's utilizing that against the normal people of this country. And when you have this... When you have things conglomerating under the House of Mouse, and it's able to control all intellectual properties, it's able to control all of these cultural touchstones that are very important to people. That's an insidiously dangerous thing to have that much ability to tap into those little nostalgia areas of our brain, those feel good areas of our brain where we feel like we had this kind of collective culture at one point and there was an expression of that. They now control all that. That is a terrifying thing. Even if that, even if some of that stuff was like Jewish in origin anyways, people have nostalgic memories attached to that. And it's so dangerous to have that under one house. Hello?
Oh, I think Johnny's been abducted. It sounded like that panic call from Area 51.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite calls. Well, I guess we can, like, if we want to go a little bit chronologically through this, then we can. What hooked me from the I was hooked from the start, and what got me in was the opening asks, "How do we even know anything?" And this is actually once you are skeptical of things you're taught in messaging, you begin, and especially if you start getting into history, you find that this is actually a common problem in historiography itself, because there's a number of tools historians apply to ascertain whether something is true or not. So, for example, one tool is the criterion of embarrassment. If someone in history admits something that is embarrassing, it's probably true unless they have some really good reason for lying about it. But this issue of having to receive information from primary sources that they themselves may be malicious or flawed, just really drives home this problem of having to receive information from an authority. And it's funny that despite having more access to information through technology, like the problem is becoming even more pronounced because we don't know where a lot of stuff is coming from anymore. It's like, what are we supposed to even make of that? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things you have to do once you start getting red-pilled is go back and audit everything you've learned, and occasionally, you catch things like that. You're like, wait, no, that just, this whole thing didn't happen. Helen Keller being a great example. it's just flat on its face absurd when you sit back and look at it.
Yeah, one other example.
Right.
Yeah,
especially stuff like that. We've been taught so many things throughout the years that have turned out to be... Sorry. Here we
go. No, go ahead.
Is it doing the bit? You guys. Yeah. Is it bad? I can't tell on my end.
I can trim the silences. That's not going to be an issue.
Okay. Well, what I was going to say is that, who was talking about Helen Keller and how that's like just absurd on its face. But then you go back and you look at other stuff throughout history and how much other stuff is just plain out and out lies. And when you look at it, you're like, how did I ever believe that in the first place? You know, no matter what it was. But this, you know, this just kind of blows your mind because it's like, well, you know, all that pizza stuff, all that pizza stuff, I guess, is real, right?
Yeah. Well, and you
that's
definitely
real. What else is real?
Yeah, you definitely have to like, you have to examine everything. I mean, just to go off another like historical example, basically everything we know about the Empress Theodora of the Eastern Roman Empire, almost all of that comes from one single man, Procopius. And he actually wrote three different contradictory histories on her, two that were positive and one that was over the top negative. And so, I mean, like, all of our history of this one woman comes from one man, and he wrote three different versions of her. Like, what is this? That's ancients we're dealing with here. So now you take this over here, and now you have all these different sources and all these different people telling you things. It's like, okay, how do I synthesize this together and figure out what's real and what isn't?
And occasionally you just have to discard the entire thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I've done. I'm the guy that doesn't believe anything anymore, ever.
And I think that's the correct approach to take, because more often than not, you just end up finding that there's glaring holes in every story. And yeah, that's why it's important to go back and audit, because this is what constructs your reality. You have to be in charge of it.
And then you combine that with the other thing that hooked me into this was when they're explaining that content made us who we are today. I mean, the early part of this documentary really drives home the pause button ethos, that people interpret their world through media. And so when people interpret the world through media, then the people who control the media control your world.
Yes, they did an excellent job of covering that. That is one thing they did a stupendous point of. What really caught me, you know, we're criticizing their mentioning of the Operation Paperclip, was they showed a Marvel movie mentioning it. And I didn't know that happened. I haven't watched any of these movies, but now I've noticed that every comment section dealing with any kind of Nazi government, whatever, it's all of the comments are just bleeding sheep about Operation Paperclip. Like, these people saw that in a movie, heard it one time, and now they apply it to everything.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. And well, they're gonna use, that was the first instance of Nazi bad in this documentary, and they do that a couple of times, which I found kind of unnecessary in this whole thing.
You want to say something, Hoob?
Yeah, they really had a ham-fisted way of tying Operation Paperclip, which, you know, of course, is the importation of Nazi scientists to this country. They just kind of slap it right on to MKUltra. I don't know that there was any crossover whatsoever between those two programs, because, as we know, MKUltra was led primarily by Jewish scientists. There was Sidney Gottlieb, and then the other one that killed the elephant with the LSD. I think is.
Hold on, it's in my notes.
Yeah, there was one scientist.
What's his name? Dom Cameron.
I looked at, he's not Jewish. When I was watching, I was desperately looking for any, because like there's very little known about his early life. I was able to find some other documents that he was the son of a Presbyterian minister in Scotland. I couldn't find anything about the mother. I looked into kind of like if there were any Jewish communities in that area. I couldn't find anything about him. I guess that, you know, the fact that he's always brought up as if you look into this, like, you'll always find a lot of news stories about this evil MK Ultra doctor and the way that in the experiments he conducted in Montreal and the people whose lives he ruined. The fact that they're allowed to go after him, I guess, would make a pretty strong case. He's probably not Jewish. The two main MK Ultra people I can think of that definitely weren't Jewish were Henry Murray and that guy, basically. And those are the names that always come up when this stuff comes up. They always downplay Sidney Gottlieb and the others.
Yeah, and they were the most demented ones of all of them.
Right, that's what I was just going to say. The guy was very sick. Whether he was escape, what he was really sick and demented. I mean, all him experiments were really disgusting at the beginning. Some of the stuff they did to people, their head, lobotomy, people doing lots of forms of psychological torture with, erase their with electrical shock therapy. I mean, it was horrible. And, whether he was just a scapegoat or not, he was still a pretty nasty guy.
Yeah, it's funny that they didn't bring up at all Henry Murray and any of the Kaczynski connections, but they might not be ready for the Ted pill on all of that just yet.
No, but the one thing they did mention is that MKUltra had a lot of sub programs to it, because I'm assuming the bulk of it was just dishing out funding to whoever was willing to take it and be a jackass with it.
Oh. Yeah, guys, keep talking. I'm gonna grab a book. I'm gonna read. I have from the Unabomber, Harvard and the Unabomber. They actually talk a little bit about this aspect of the CIA and the universities. Let me go grab it. There's a great passage from it.
Okay,
this nigga can't go 2 minutes without reaching for a book.
I know. Somebody get a rock. But speaking of that connection. You see the CIA all over all of this stuff, going back to Disney. You see the CIA connection with the government making propaganda. Was it the vice president of Disney was in charge of wartime propaganda during World War II?
Yeah, and you know what? I had no idea that the CIA was involved with helping Disney purchase the swampland in Florida.
I was shocked by that, too.
They didn't really even kind of go in, because that's the other thing they do is they give you a bunch of tabs where you can pull on it and do your own dive as you will.
Yeah, and I still don't understand. That's a lot of swampland. Okay. The CIA wanted to set up a government program where they socially experiment and psychologically experiment on people en masse and call it entertainment, right? Walt Disney World or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's the perfect place to have that kind of thing. And the other psychologist I was thinking of was Dr. West. He was the one that was involved with Charles Manson, Tusco the Elephant, and Jack Rubinstein, who, after Dr. West visited him in jail, Jack Ruby started complaining about sounds of boiling Jewish children in the jail. So Dr. West showed up, slipped him a straight crystal gram of LSD and fried his brain, I think.
That is very highly likely, not just plausible, but likely.
Yeah, because nobody in Ruby's life had ever complained about him being... anything beyond an asshole before that. And now after this, he's just having complete hallucinations all the time.
All right. So this is from Harvard and the Unabomber by Alston Chase. Throughout the post-war period, the biggest employer of college professors would be the Central Intelligence Agency, whose ties to the academic world, University of Georgia historian Locke Johnson writes, extended back to the day the agency opened its doors in 1947. Each of the four CIA directorates and several subsidiary units within them have been involved in a wide range of associations with colleges, universities, research groups, think tanks, technical schools, secretarial schools, and even high schools throughout the country and abroad. The relationships defy simple description. Eventually, the CIA would have so many professors on its payroll at hundreds of different universities serving in so many different capacities that even the agency itself couldn't keep track of them. In 1967, according to John D. Marks and former CIA officer Victor Marchetti, Director Richard Helms asked his staff to find out just how many university personnel were under secret contract to the CIA. After a few days of investigation, Helms immediately ordered a full study of the situation, and after more than a month of searching records all over the agency, a report was handed in to Helms listing hundreds of professors and administrators on over 100 campuses. But the staff officers who compiled the report knew their work was incomplete. Even so, the committee found hundreds of college professors who had been given special clearance by the agency's Office of Security to perform a wide variety of tasks for different CIA components. The Directorate of Science and Technology employed individual professors and at times entire university departments or research institutes for its research and developmental development projects.
Oh, wow. So the government is in the colleges and it's right there. I mean, well, that stuff that we've all been saying, us in the, you know, us conspiratards have been saying stuff for years, and there it is. I mean, it's true. They're in the schools, they're in your media.
Yeah. Now I wonder if that was part of Operation Mockingbird, which, you know, was in the, which they cover in the film as well, where, you know, the CIA was just had media personalities on the payroll. I wonder if that same one extended to academia.
Well, I don't know if it
extended to academia. I want to say that there's, I want to say that the academia program is separate from the media program. To be fair.
And the thing about the CIA, and I'm going to keep reading because this actually explains this a little even further. The thing about it is, like, it doesn't have to be officially under the umbrella of a single operation. As we've seen, like, the CIA tends to have its, you know, fingers in a lot of different pies, and there's a lot of cross-pollination. So, because the way to think of the CIA is less of a formal organization and more of an informal network of people who want to control, basically, to be able to control as much as they can and weaponize it as much as possible. They tend to be very informal in how they conduct a lot of their operations, which is why it's really hard to try to track some of these things down and track these people down, because they keep it that way intentionally. But the old school tie sustained the CIA university connection. Recruited during the war, mostly from the Ivy League, OSS veterans stayed in touch with each other as some joined the CIA and others returned to the universities. They became a kind of shadow fraternity in which brothers in government and those in the universities continued to help each other. The psychologists in this fraternity formed what Carnegie Corporation president John Gardner called the Behavior Science Network, in which philanthropies such as Ford, Rockefeller, and Russell Sage foundations and Carnegie Corporation, at the behest of their friends in the CIA, Department of Defense, and executive branch, supported secret research with their private funds, thus ensuring that this research would remain off budget and would never be exposed to congressional oversight. Where individuals such as Nelson Rockefeller, who served both in government and on the board of powerful foundations, simply arranged the funding themselves. To further conceal its support, the CIA employed other channels as well. It contracted with private Twilight Zone research think tanks, such as the RAND Corporation, to hire professors for specific research. It relied on legitimate federal funding agencies, such as the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Science Foundation, to support favored projects. It channeled monies through cooperators, legitimate philanthropies, and other nonprofit organizations. And it made grants through entirely bogus foundations set up for the purpose. As the Congressional Quarterly explained, the CIA probably used at least 50 foundations in an involved method of funneling funds to certain organizations. Under a method of transfer known as the triple pass, the usual procedure was for the CIA to convey funds to dummy foundations it had established to act as fronts for its activities. The dummy foundations then made grants to legitimate foundations. These foundations, which also handled other funds, then made grants to certain CIA-designated organizations using funds from the dummy foundations. Thanks to this indirection, often a professor didn't know he was working for a defense intelligence agency. The CIA called these people unwitting agents, as for example in the following 1958 agency memo. Funding and nominal supervision of this project will be handled by the name of Conduit Redacted in the regular manner. Accounting for the funds expended will be according to the procedures previously established for the redacted relative to grants to unwitting agents. And this is the last paragraph I'll read on this. In these ways, the CIA enlisted the talents of many on the Harvard faculty, which in 1952 found itself the beneficiary of no less than 160 clandestine defense contracts. By 1960, according to one Harvard history, 3/4 of all Harvard University research was funded by the government, much of it at the behest of the Defense Department. Between 1953 and 63, federal support for Harvard research increased from $8 million to $30 million. By 1959, these monies exceeded tuition revenues. And while Harvard was not the only beneficiary, many of its professors were among the most loyal friends of the covert intelligence establishment.
Harvard is literally a military-industrial research program with a really nice library.
Yeah, founded by the Puritans, of all things.
Yeah.
Sure. You know.
Did y'all see that Epstein had his own office and like line at Harvard this whole time?
When we did the Epstein thing, we talked about all the connections at Harvard. We could do a deep dive on Harvard in and of itself. There's so much, that whole thing glows in the dark all the way around since forever, pretty much. And so many things connected to it besides Epstein, which was really weird to me that he has, not just his own office, but a little research lab there too and stuff. It's
I know I've talked about this a lot, but do you guys know kind of like the full story behind the whole Kaczynski experiment over there? A lot of people like just know that Henry Murray did an unethical experiment on Ted Kaczynski. A lot of people don't know some of the weirder circumstances of that. The most mysterious thing of all is, how did Kaczynski end up in this program in the first place? Because the program was it was meant to see, can you basically break talented, young, gifted young students. It was said to be a personality test type thing, and you were supposed to present your argument and then defend your personal ethos. But the way that they recruited this was that the people that they signed up for it, you had to hear about it in a psychology class. Kaczynski didn't take psychology classes. He was there for math classes. He would not have been in any of the classes that were basically selling, like, hey, come join this this experiment, which, is different than what we're going to actually do to you. And he was a 17-year-old kid at this time as well. He was a 16 or 17-year-old kid. He was 17 years old when he started the experiment. Young guy. He came there as a gifted, somewhat awkward kid to that school. Somebody recruited him for this. There's just like, that's the only way he would have ended up in that experiment. Henry Murray in his notes took a keen interest in Kaczynski. There's a lot of gaps in the story, and Kaczynski himself is very glib about exactly what happened. He said a number of contradicting things about it, and he's kind of winked and nodded. It's like, that the Henry Murray Institute won't make his files public. He says one wonders if they have anything to hide, and he kind of leaves it at that. It's very strange that Kaczynski ended up in that program unless he was specifically targeted to bring into that. And we know from Murray's notes, he took a keen interest in Kaczynski. It's a very, very weird stuff.
It's a full-blown grooming operation. I mean, it really is.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I don't see it as anything else. I mean, that was, it's a really crazy story. Like you said, most people don't know too much about it. I only know because, I started reading because, Piney Gang, I didn't really know anything about this guy, Ted Kaczynski, and I didn't know about the Harvard connection until I read it. And yeah, that just solidifies a lot more of what I already believe is going on up there in Massachusetts.
There was, I guess, getting back to the documentary proper, I know this subject, and I have this in my notes, this subject is very near and dear to your heart, Johnny, because this has kind of been the thing I think the paranormies have hammered home the most that people need to be cognizant of, is that there's a religious component in a lot of these modern-day conspiracies, and there's a strong stress on the importance of ritual, which this documentary does briefly cover.
And
yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's so much ritual stuff. Everything that Hollywood does or television does, whether it's a Super Bowl halftime show, the VMAs, the Grammys, this is all ritual. And like we say on the Paranormies, whether or not you believe it, they do. It gives them power. It does whatever it does, it works, because they've got everybody under control pretty much, other than a very few of us weirdos. Yeah, and it's very much a ritual thing that they do, and a lot of it involves ritual sacrifice of children.
And on that note, they bring up the excellent point of the Disney movies often dealing with loss of a parent, to traumatize the viewer or the child in the movie itself.
Now I'm going to play devil's advocate on that. Maybe this is just something that they co-opted because they saw the effectiveness of it. As I understood, I thought that had to do, like, that element of Disney was the result of Walt Disney himself and his issues with his mother. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, or maybe they just co-opted the traumatic aspect of that. But as I understand it, that origin just kind of comes from Walt Disney's, his own personal trauma.
Right, but the psychology behind that whole thing of traumatizing somebody at the beginning of whatever you're watching, it allows you to... it's like you were talking about earlier, how media can shape reality. You know, if you watch something that's fiction, your mind watches it a different way than if it's nonfiction. So if you're traumatized at the beginning of something, now and later on throughout the movie, you know, you bring some sort of a release, right? So the kid's traumatized from seeing, you know, Mufasa get thrown off the cliff in The Lion King or whatever. You know, now it's like, what's the story there is, watch out for your uncle. He might kill your dad, kid. You know, but at the end of the movie, you know, Simba becomes the king and it's all good again. So they release the trauma at the end. And that's what gives a lot more of the emotion to the movie. Well, that is mind control. I mean, that is a form of mind control to do that. The people using that, that's a form of psychological mind control.
But I mean, because that aspect of The Lion King, for instance, is a lot of that's just retelling Hamlet. I mean, the same, it follows that same structure.
Right, but for kids, but that's the thing is, every Disney movie pretty much is, okay, you know, they're either an orphan, the parent gets killed. No parent to begin with. I mean, look at this. Look at the story of Finding Nemo. It's, what is it? Man witnesses his entire family murdered except for one of his children, who's left a cripple, who is then kidnapped and taken across the planet. And he has to go on a journey with a psychopath or a crazy person to find a kid. Like, that's the story of Finding Nemo. You know what I mean?
No lies detected there.
Psychopath is none other than Ellen DeGeneres. Criminal,
yes, exactly. It's Ellen DeGeneres, right? Like,
you know that movie. Ellen. Yeah, that movie made relatives of mine who didn't like the gays. Like, they actually, that movie actually made them like her. So I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, and but the thing, if you take the plot of most Disney movies out of the cartoon and like write it down, some of that stuff's pretty fucked up, you know. And it is traumatizing to kids to see that sort of thing. You have to imagine a four-year-old kid watching that scene in Finding Nemo where the barracuda comes in, and you know, you're emotionally attached to this family. You see, they're trying to you know, they're talking about the dad's like, hey, we bought this house, look at this view, isn't this awesome? Hey, we're gonna name the kids, blah blah blah, whatever. And all of a sudden, you know, a barracuda comes in and eats all of his kids and kills his wife. I mean, like, to a four-year-old, that's gotta be traumatizing. I mean, to me, I'm a grown up. It's a cartoon. I'm like, wow, that's pretty messed up. And then, like, you know, then the movie starts. But like, that stuff is trauma, and they always do it at the beginning of the movie. Near the beginning of the movie is when the bad thing happens. It's part of the formula that Disney put together. And I don't know if Walt had something to do with it, but Bambi was what, in the 60s, 50s?
No, it's like 1940s, I believe.
40s? Okay.
That's an early Walt Disney movie. That definitely right. Has Walt's hand in it.
But the thing with Bambi is the mom gets killed towards the end. It's not like at the beginning of the movie where you're traumatized for the entire movie. I think they figured that out a few movies into it.
Yeah, that's 1942. Yeah, I was correct. That's 1942. That's very early Disney film.
Yeah.
So then maybe I'm correct then, is that this is like that there's this aspect of loss that this organic sense of loss that was in these early Disney films, and then later after Walt's gone, they co-opted, you know, that the power of that kind of storytelling to make it add the trauma right at the start.
Sure, I believe that 100%. I still have a hard time with, like, you see in this documentary, you see how Disney was connected, you know, to the CIA early.
True. And, yeah.
No. Not Disney. And you're like, maybe Walt didn't know. You know, like, not Walt. Good one. He hates the Jews.
Yeah, it's one day we'll do like a whole thing on Walt Disney himself, because he's a very complicated person. And unfortunately, every time you go into this stuff, you always discuss, like, anyone who you like tends to come out not looking as shinier as you once thought.
Oh, right. It's like when I found out Bill Murray went to Pedophile Island.
No. There was
that one hurt the world.
That was and speaking of like the CIA being involved in films, I was shocked to find out that Dulles was involved in Thunderball. One of those things, like when you think about I guess that's obvious, but.
Well, Dulles wasn't just involved in Thunderball. Dulles recruited Ian Fleming to do James Bond to begin with.
Right.
Yeah. So like Ian Fleming was like basically astroturfed from, you know, and groomed basically to do this.
Sorry, Richard. Even James Bond was a gay op.
Oh.
Yeah. Got him. Yeah. Oof. Hadn't thought about that angle, but that's a good one, Borzoi.
It's rough. Like, it's always rough to go back to. I mean, I guess maybe just because I'm so jaded and cynical, like I don't expect anything good out of the hot thing to come out of this world anymore in terms of media. Right. But it always like when I have like I said, I watched this documentary of somebody who couldn't believe what they were seeing. And they were shocked by all this. I guess this is why people always get frustrated with my show, The Pause Button. It's like I always ruin movies for people. It's like, well, you know, I'm just telling you how media is. Like, that's just like this is the awful truth. Media is a weapon. I mean, like when I point out that it's a gun and the gun is firing at you, I don't know what you want from me. Like, I'm just telling you what's happening.
Right. It's one of those things where now I don't feel so bad because, you know, it's like people are, Johnny, just let people enjoy things. No, you can't because
Johnny,
you have to see
Johnny, just let them take the bullet that's coming towards their head.
Sure, I guess.
Just let them enjoy the bullet. Let them enjoy the brain damage.
Right. And so it's hard, you know. I don't know. I remember the first time I started talking to Sven, one of the things we mentioned was, you know, like getting, oh, look, now everybody's leaving the barbecue because you're ranting about Jews again, you know. But it's, you know, it's the same thing with movies. Talk about movies. Next thing you know, everybody's not talking to you anymore because you just pointed out that that's a dude and not a woman. You know, like, oh, and by the way, everybody, be prepared to have your jimmies rustled by X series from Paranormies.
What are you ruining this time, Johnny?
Women?
Yep.
Women, the ultimate gay op.
Women are officially canceled in Hollywood.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's going to be fun. Dogbot has done the staring into the void for me. I started, and then I let him go, and he's gone autistically off on this, and it's going to be great. People are going to be mad, so it's going to be fun. But anyways, back to this thing, being a gay op and the CIA being involved in everything. It was Alan Dulles. Was it Alan? Okay, so
Alan Dulles.
I had notes on him, and I can't find it now. Oh yeah, were the Dulles brothers responsible for writing the Treaty of Versailles?
I know one of the Dulles brothers was in Switzerland when Lenin was trying to get out of Switzerland to get to get a train from the Germans into Russia, and it was Alan Dulles. A lot of people don't know this. Let me pull up this little story. A lot of people do not know about the Alan Dulles and Lenin connection. So initially assigned to Vienna, he was transferred to Bern, Switzerland, along with the rest of the embassy personnel shortly before the U.S. entered the First World War. Later in life, Dulles claimed to have been telephoned by Vladimir Lenin seeking a meeting with the American embassy on April 8, 1917, the day before Lenin left Switzerland to travel to St. Petersburg aboard a German train. After recovering from the 1918 flu pandemic, he was assigned to the American delegation at the Paris Peace Conference along with his older brother, Foster.
Oh. What a surprise. He survived the original coup. I wonder how fake and gay the Spanish flu really was.
Are we doing this now?
No. You brought it up. Lenin and Alan Dulles. So Alan Dulles is the original George Herbert Walker Bush. Like, you know how anything past JFK, if something went bad, Bush was there, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Alan Dulles was the original Herbert Walker Bush.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't even know about the Lennon Dulles connection until I listened to Richard Spence, not Spencer, Professor Richard Spence, his great courses lecture series on secret societies, which is probably one of the best great courses I've ever listened to. I was blown away when I learned about the Dulles Lennon connection.
Yeah, it's amazing how many communists have been, you know, close to American officials. I mean, from Abraham Lincoln being pen pals with Karl Marx to Dulles, you know, Lenin connection to Uncle Joe and FDR.
You know how there's 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. We might need to start in terms of the CIA communist and Hollywood connection. We might need to start doing 6 degrees of Alan Dulles.
That'd only be 1 degree every time.
It would. Maybe two tops.
It'd be like, bro, it's in his most recent phone calls.
Yes. Yeah. He was a bad person, man. Responsible for a lot of bad things, connected to a lot of bad stuff. And, you know, and we named an airport after him. One of the biggest. Isn't it weird, like, the bigger of a Zog puppet you are, the better monument you get? Like, you know, what was his name? Norm Mineta got the San Jose International Airport after he allowed the whatever to hit the Pentagon.
Yeah, that's the problem of a lot of American nationalism. Unless the symbols you're going to are folk symbols of some kind, like basically most symbols of American patriotism, American nationalism are Zog symbols. They're government symbols. Like you can try to co-opt them if you want to try, but they fundamentally belong to them, not you. The only things that belong to us are the folk symbols. That's what belongs to us.
Right. Right. You don't own none of this, Graham.
Yeah, I think after, to get back to the film, after they covered MK Ultra in the Disney thing is when, for me, it really took off. And that's when they started piling it on so thick and so deep that you could take each topic and do your own entire series of Paranormies topics on. Because after that, the next thing they went into is Rosemary's Baby. Which,
right. Roman Polanski.
Yeah, Roman Polanski tied to everybody, tied to the Manson murders, tied to MK Ultra through Dr. West, and also starring, or not starring, maybe featuring Anton LaVey. And this is just where the tone of the movie changes once they introduce this character. And we all know him as the founder of the Church of Satan. He's actually a Jewish man.
He's just a big Jewish nerd.
Yeah.
Right.
It's all show. It's just a big show. There's nothing to it.
Yeah, but may have been a show, but he attracted very, very prominent, very important people. And I guess with Anton LaVey and then like Michael Aquino, that's where you start to see they realize that in order to like spook the masses, to chase them down, like have them go down, look at different things or kind of create the smoke and mirrors effect, or maybe they're just trying to tap into power another power themselves. Whatever it is, they know that there's a level of ritual showmanship you need to add to this, especially if you want to operate in the open. So adding this whole Church of Satan aspect is meant to, you know, both to scare, beguile, confuse you in all of this while they're still, you know, while they're allowed to do what they want to do, either behind the scenes or right in front of your face, usually a combination of the two.
Exactly.
Right.
It is a live performance art psyop.
Right. A lot, just like spirit cooking nowadays. But back then, You had you know, actors that were into it. The one that really got me was when Eddie Murphy started talking about Sammy Davis Jr. being a Satanist.
Yeah, that was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, but what's funny is he's riding with Seinfeld, who's actually a Moloch-worshipping baby dick sucker. So,
yeah. So he was getting a totally different laugh out of it than Eddie was.
Right. Oh, you could see it by looking at Seinfeld's face. He was like, you know, Satan.
Elbows him over the console of the car like, oh, come on, man. You don't know what you're getting into here.
The funniest tweet you did, Hoop, was like, because like they, while they're having that conversation, it flashes that picture on the screen of Anton LaVey, Sammy Davis Jr., and Michael Aquino. And you point out Michael Aquino is the only non-Jew in this picture.
Yeah. And that's the other thing is we have the intro of Michael Aquino, and any seasoned conspiracy researcher is going to have seen this guy's name all over the place. Most notably with the Phoenix program in Vietnam.
So what, like, for the uninitiated, what is the Phoenix program?
The Phoenix program was basically psychological terror. And this was Michael Aquino's specialty. You can actually hear on YouTube audio that they used to blast from helicopters above Vietnam of just like horrifying sounds, dead soldiers talking about their regret that they'll never see their children again, like searching for their friends and stuff.
Well, and they were also playing off of Vietnamese folk traditions and superstitions and beliefs as well, of like the kind of ghosts that they believed in over there, to terrify them by adding that element to it. To be like, you know, if you were to like wage war on Ireland, like then you like you include as part of your psychological terror banshee elements into what you're blasting.
Or, you know, there's no potatoes.
Yeah, right.
Right. But the other thing, well, and then you got to remember that in Vietnam, you also have the Vietnamese Batutu running around in the jungles anyways. So you got these Viet Cong guys that have to be scared of the Vietnamese Bigfoot and Michael Aquino and his helicopter psychological torture.
Yeah, and there's a lot to look into with that. I would recommend any interested readers check out Dave McGowan's writings on the Phoenix program.
Yeah, he's the one who basically makes a strong case that the idea that basically serial killers are a social construct, that the idea of the media idea of the serial killer is a complete construct and it's completely fake and gay. Now, which is not to say that murders never happened, but that oftentimes there's often accomplices that are not known about. Murders are attributed to people that they probably didn't commit, and that the media has you focused on this idea of what the killer is that's completely divorced from the reality of what most sociopathic killers are like.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it's really true. Dave McGowan does a lot of really good work. He did a lot of the work for some of the moon landing hoax episodes that we did. He also wrote a book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, talking about Laurel Canyon.
Yes.
And Laurel Canyon and CIA are connected to this, which is really funny because we just recorded our first Laurel Canyon episode last night. So the paranormies are doing a dive into Laurel Canyon. We're doing this, which connects to Laurel Canyon. Very, very coincidental.
Okay.
Inside. Yeah. Really spooky. Right. Well, inside Laurel Canyon, you have a place, what's it called? Lookout Mountain Studios, which the Air Force Base there, where I don't know how many movies were filmed there, just military propaganda, not to mention, you know, actual Hollywood movies. And what's funny that this former military base is now owned by cult leader Jared Leto.
Yep. And you know, I mean, like that whole area, that whole California scene has such a long history of this. I mean, like there's Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard like trying to create the Moonchild, and Aleister Crowley's asks us, what are these retards doing out there? Because he was appalled at what they were trying to do out there. You know, there's and then past Jack Parsons, you know, in between that and the Anton LaVey stuff, you have like the Laurel Canyon. Like a lot of people don't know this. Like all those movers and shakers of the 50s and 60s and these hippie icons. Although these were all military brats. These were all the kids of military people who were out there. And I mean, Nick Mason and the Myth guys have talked about the Little Canyon connection as well with Charlie Manson and all that. I know we just touched on that briefly just a few minutes ago. But yeah, all these things were connected. All these people knew each other. These people created their own incestuous network of influence and power. And then they had at their disposal the ultimate tool, like the movie camera. They were in proximity to media and to people involved in media.
Yeah, and if it seems like we're kind of doubling back and going back and forth, it's because all of this stuff is woven together so well, and the movie does a great job of presenting it that way, so that by the time you're three quarters of the way through, it's kind of calling back to something in the first quarter, the first half hour, whatever, and it just really ties it all up so well.
Yeah, it's really well-produced, well-put-together documentary. I haven't seen one like this in a long time that actually really got me, you know, because being into conspiracies as much as I am, I've seen all the documentaries, seen all the films, all the stuff. This one, like I said, at the beginning, I'm like, this is kind of like boring, whatever. And then got it into the Pizzagate stuff and then the CIA stuff and then the Laurel Canyon stuff. And like, there's so much more stuff. I mean, we haven't even gotten into all like the sex cult stuff. There's more. There's so much more in this documentary. We just started touching on Satanism, right? So was there anything else with Satanism that we missed? I forgot. There was something I wanted to say about that, and I can't remember what it was.
Well, I would like to say that I think Michael Aquino deserves his own episode of Paranormies by far. This guy, he's got it going on, let me tell you.
Yes, I agree with you there. After doing this, I had heard Michael Aquino. I know about the Phoenix program. I didn't know how deep this guy went. We could easily do 2 hours on just Michael Aquino and his eyebrows, really. I think he's the only guy I know that gives Hoveter a run for his money with those brows.
By the way, because I think we kind of moved a little bit past the CIA thing, I had no idea that 1 month after Kennedy was assassinated that former President Truman had written an editorial against the role of the CIA.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It's like that. It was kind of like when Eisenhower wrote his little thing about the military industrial complex. Like, they always tell you about it a little bit afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy how all this stuff kind of comes together and all comes out. And again, you know, of course, they tie in the Nazi scientists to everything. Couple times, not they do Nazi bad. A couple times, they talk about Ravensburg Castle and the E-Magic. Did you notice that when they did talk about the National Socialists and whatever, and the Annenerbe, which we still haven't done an episode on the Annenerbe really on my show.
The Annenerbe when they talk never presents the Annenerbe.
Yes, how the movie, like the music got dark, the contrast got dark on the film, like, you know, even on this documentary, they present the Nazi, you know, Nazi Germany as Nazi bad.
Yeah. Well, that's the one reason why they do this is because people are so Nazi doesn't effectively mean anything other than like, well, this is pure evil. So the whole purpose of that being in there, and this is, you know, an unfortunate thing that we have to break people of, but that's the permission slip within the documentary. That's the permission slip that allows you to hate these people, because people have sometimes drag their feet in order to engage in, you know, seeing evil for what evil is, because they've been so their brains have been so broken by this liberal society that you're not supposed to ever judge or look down or, you know, look untoward at anybody. And it's so like, you have to put the Nazi permissions up. It's like, well, it's a Nazi. Oh, now I can hate them to my heart's content.
Yeah, and you know, and it makes sense that they do that. I mean, even what was her name, Whitney Webb, in that interview that she just did, when she was a kidnapped you know, she was a kidnappee of Epstein and whatever, and she was tortured and, like, you know, not sacrificed, but sexually abused and whatever. But whenever she talked about racism towards Jews or towards blacks, she still felt bad about it, you know, yeah. Even though she, you know, it's still programmed into people.
Yeah, I know people who have been victims of that, of similar stuff like that, and it's, they, until they can get past it, they struggle really hard with, like, I'm not supposed to think bad about these people, but, like, these are the people who hurt me, and you have to, like, unfortunately, like, sometimes, this is where the individual person-by-person level comes in, like, you have to be the person that helps them along, and lets them say, like, yeah, you can say whatever you want, just speak your mind. Like, these are the people that hurt you. And yeah, they did it because you may have convinced yourself that you don't see race, but they see race and they abused you on a racial level.
And I just want to add, the person abused was Maria Farmer, who is currently suffering from a massive brain tumor, and she has no money. She has a GoFundMe out there. If anybody wants, they can go look for it. Whitney Webb is the journalist that interviewed her, and she has done some of the most fantastic work on Epstein and a lot of other stuff regarding Israel, everything creepy and bad with that.
Right. I get that backwards. That's my bad. But yeah, so they gave you the Nazi permission slip so you can hate these people. But he never quite gets around to naming who they, you know, other than, you know, people in Hollywood and whatever. You know, does he really get into, well, they talk about a little bit with James Olifantis and Pizzagate. You know, they don't really mention too many names, though, in this documentary.
Yeah, they don't talk about, like, the thing that my friend was really shocked by was the paintings. The paintings was what, and they don't show the Kim Noble paintings in this one. They just show the, Djurjevic or something like that. It was another Serbian or Yugoslavian name for the ones of the swimming pool kids, basically the ones that are in Podesta's possession. Of this whole documentary, that was the part that shocked the most. And it's kind of funny to me in that because we lived through that whole 2016 insanity, and all, like, every day was always something different. Every day there was always some new revelation. Every day there was always some new little tidbit of information we were obsessing over. And then after the election, we just kind of, like, there were some people who stayed on it, but there are a lot of people we were satisfied enough that Trump had been elected, and we kind of just let it lay by the wayside. It never occurred, like, just, you kind of forget, like, there are people who actually weren't paying attention in 2016. So when I had somebody who was seeing this for the first time, they couldn't believe what they were seeing with these paintings and the sculpture of the Dahmer victim that Podesta has and all that.
Yeah, the big gold sculpture of the dead guy from Jeffrey Dahmer's house. That's kind of an interesting piece. Why would you have that in your house? You know, everything about John and Tony Podesta is just really, really creepy with the artwork. And then you bring in what's her name there? Liz Crokin?
Liz Crokin, yes.
That's your favorite, right? Who? She's awesome.
I think she does a really good presentation.
That was the journalist who basically got, they call her a crazy person, although but you see her talk, she doesn't come across crazy as well at all. She was the Pizzagate reporter,
right,
is that?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. She, man, you know, they were talking about Podesta and Pizzagate and stuff, and what she brings up is, no matter what anybody says, they can't explain the coded language. Like, there's no explanation for, you can't Occam's razor talk your way around it, no matter how many times friends of ours have tried. You know, who, you guys have been in groups with me where certain people with names would just be like, Beaton Gang did not actually say the thing that, you know,
yeah, like, you know, did they actually find children in a pizza parlor? And it's like, no, you son of a bitch. It's about the emails. It's always been about the emails. How do you get an hour of pizza?
Right. How do you have a pizza related map on handkerchief?
Yeah. What the hell is that? They still can't answer this.
That's one of the weirdest things. Like a pizza.
I can see a
pizza handkerchief. I can see a map handkerchief, but a pizza map handkerchief, that's a little, I don't know. I don't, like,
mm-hmm. that's, how about, How about can
you,
renting
can you show me a can you show me a pizza map handkerchief?
Yeah. How about, dude, how about renting the children for, you know, will there be the one where like so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so are available for rental? What? None of those emails, like none of it makes sense to normal people. And then like friends of ours try to explain it with Occam's razor and I'm the crazy one for thinking that this is what it says. Well, of course Obama got hot dogs from Chicago. He's from Chicago. And of course he paid $65,000 for it. It's the president. Who cares?
That one I can almost believe. It's the other ones that are like that, like the language of it just doesn't make any sense.
Bro, you get like three hot dogs for a dollar. What are you doing with 60 grand worth of freaking hot dogs? How many wieners can you choke down?
Right. Right. But the Chinese guy with a cup of water, you know what I mean? Your cousin. What's his name? The hot dog eating guy? Jeremy.
That's Japanese. Kobayashi.
Kobayashi. I'm sorry. You guys all look alike. I'm sorry. So. But yeah. The coded language, like. The emails, like Anthony Weiner's email, these people, like, they have all this Chuck stuff. Wiener. You have, is it Chuck Weiner?
No, just because I'm calling him Chuck. You know, it's Anthony Weiner, but Chuck, I'm calling him Chuck Weiner.
Yeah. Okay, so Chuck Weiner, yeah, there's so, I mean, all these people are all connected, but Podesta and Hillary Clinton and, you know, and Hillary Clinton with her frazzle drop video or whatever the fuck that was on the dark web that I saw like 5 seconds of and threw my laptop, the laptop I was watching it on, I no longer own, excuse me, NSA, no bully. But like all this stuff, these people do this, you know, and the fucked up part is you can see, you know, people, you know, Jeffrey Epstein, you know, Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. Jeffrey Epstein was this big pedophile. Well, we have the flight logs of all the people who went there. We know what they did there. Why is, you know, nobody redacted? You know what I mean? Like, none of this stuff. People know this stuff. Everybody knows this stuff. You know, in a world without this media that softens our brains and our bodies, these people wouldn't be getting away with this. And it's the media that's causing us to not, like, really rage over this shit.
You know who we haven't heard from in the last 3 years at all? It's kind of funny that you think about it. Huma Abedin. Like, literally, I haven't heard anything from her. I mean, not since she divorced Weiner. Like, I haven't heard anything about that woman. And she was, and obviously, the Clintons are a little bit less out of the spotlight now. But it's just kind of funny when you think about it. Like, we haven't heard about anything about Huma Abedin in a long time.
Well, Bill just did a COVID vaccine thing, so Bill's back, and he wants you to get your shots. But yeah, Huma Abedin disappearing is weird because everybody knows that's like Hillary Clinton's lesbian lover who was married to Anthony Weiner, who had the pigs of child porn on the Clinton campaign laptop.
Oh, okay, there she is. Huma Abedin joins Hillary for, this was from May and March, Huma Abedin joins Hillary for NYC premiere of documentary that shows behind-the-scenes footage of former First Lady's failed presidential bid.
Did it show her wiping a heart with a cloth?
when the movie started getting into this Pizzagate stuff, it's like the first time I was watching it, I should shut it off because it was too stressful to like go back to all this stuff, considering the post Epstein atmosphere we're still in, where it's like, holy crap, the FBI only exists to protect organized crime and to get rid of the competition to cover everything up. It's just, it's so stressful. Yeah. It's amazing to sit there and look at the sheer scale of it all.
I'm so glad I watched this with somebody who was uninitiated, who didn't know about any of the stuff. And I think that's one of the greatest values of this, is that you know somebody who's willing to kind of like hear you out on this, and they don't know any of the stuff. Show this to them, watch it with them, and watch their reaction. Because one problem that we tend to have is because we marinate in this stuff so much, and we're either schizophrenics ourselves or we're schizo adjacent. So like we know that, we all know that, or it's just like we have our own language and way of how we're just too close to it in a certain sense. And so when you actually see a first time reaction to it, it kind of really drives home how important it is to be able to frame this and present this to people, so they can so they go like, what the hell's going on? Why has this never been explained? Like, this person was connected to Jeffrey Epstein. What the hell is going on? It's because like we're so used to this stuff and we're just kind of jaded. Some of us can get jaded by it, but show this to somebody who has no idea about any of this stuff and gauge their reaction. It's a great way of kind of recentering yourself and figuring out like, how do we talk about this stuff?
Yeah. My friends that recommended this to me, they, you know, after I watched it, I kind of wanted to know more what they thought about it. I'm like, how do you guys still feel about like watching regular Talmud vision? And it's just like, you know, light switch brain, just like jaws open. Like, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, oh, okay. That's it, I guess.
I'm trying to remember the name, that quote from the Catholic priest that was, what was like, having a television in your living room is like having a Jew in your living room.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth. It's just open mind control.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. They tell you about it right in your face. It's your programming. Your programs that are programming your brain. It's your television, like they say. What was it, television, or like tell a lie? Some people would like tell a lie to your vision, television, like it's like right there in front of you. Your channels, your programming directly into your brain. It's like Disney is doing Imagineering for you. It's like, what? Well, you don't have to imagine it, they will imagine it for you.
I think it's a different route. I thought it was for a second there, it might be related to that TV might be related to telos, the Greek word, but I think maybe that's may not be the etymology.
No, it's not. Somebody tried to do that to me once. Like, nah, it's not, John.
We're doing like Black Hebrew Israelite etymology here with this. It's sure, like it's totally called for.
Yeah. Well, he does that a little bit in the documentary.
Sometimes
as well.
That works.
Yeah.
Sometimes it shows. Yeah. They're not wrong 100% of the time. No, but like, yeah, you can't know. I mean, like television. Okay, so what do you got? Hollywood is Hollywood. You entertain. What does entertain mean? It means to hold. All of the talk about etymology behind the words. Hollywood, it's the Hollywood. It's a place where these magic black spells were cast. All the wizards in all the movies and all the books, and the wizards use a holly staff, you know, a holly wand or whatever. You know, it's like it's right there. You know, but no, but you're just a retard, you know, black African Hebrew Israelite if you believe that shit. Water come from the bank. You know, money in the bank and water.
Currency.
But they're not wrong there either. They're just black.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that shit's not Justin. Look, what's his name? Jordan Maxwell wasn't wrong when he talked about all that stuff. He's just nuts, you know.
Yeah, crazy people aren't always wrong.
No, yes. and that's what I've learned is that, like, you know, I got this essentially from Schizo Twitter, and I've developed a great admiration for these people. Like, if you get
Those are my friends.
If like Microsoft was just about to hire Marina Abramović for an ad campaign, and the QAnon crowd went nuts. They went, who knows what these people did, but Microsoft canceled that.
Yep.
Like that lady's in fear for her life now because like some dude all hopped up on Mountain Dew is just spamming Twitter with this video at her constantly.
Well, they had to go back and like kind of retcon her story a little bit, and it was pretty fucking funny because she's got a really shitty internet presence. I mean, it's really spooky, nasty, dark, grisly, and you know, and now she did that commercial, and there's some really dark occult stuff in that commercial. And like, what the fuck were you thinking, Bill Gates? That's not how you get everybody to take your vaccine, okay? You don't scare the shit out. You know, that's not how you scare them. But like, yeah, the Q-tard Twitter got a hold of him, and that commercial was gone like quickly. You know, faster than the Gillette, the gay razor commercial. Remember that one?
The gazer.
Yeah. Or the anti-white. I'm sorry, the anti-white razor commercial, but which is a really weird combination of words.
This is the stuff you got to talk about in the current year.
Yeah. No, it absolutely is, man. Like, you have the trans agenda, you have the gay agenda, and it's all being pushed by these CIA nerds in Hollywood. You know?
Well, a reminder, because I was looking at my notes, and we kind of, like, I didn't get a chance to go kind of, like, touch on it. This is a good, remember, CIA has an entertainment liaison division.
In every single television and movie studio has one.
Yeah, one of the striking things they mentioned that I really, like, one of those things you just, like, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right, that's a good point, is that after a certain point, the television and film was no longer critical of intelligence agencies. Like, if you go back in media, I think around maybe, like, especially, like, maybe in the 70s, because that's when the church committees the church committee occurred, you saw a skepticism towards the intelligence community, towards the CIA, they were not well regarded. But now the transformation is now complete now that we have, like, the woke whammons in charge of the CIA. But they have worked overtime to rehabilitate their image in media to make sure it's presented as nothing but a, like, even if, like, there's a dark side, like, they present the dark side of the CIA, to do that in that gritty kind of, like, oh, we're dangerous, you don't want to mess with us kind of way, like, just to scare the shit out of you. It's like, to make them see, it's like, no, you know what the vast majority of the CIA is? It's a bunch of fat nerds that have too much power. That's what it is.
Exactly. Some CIA nerd shows up in my house right now, I'll slap the shit out of him.
Yeah. It's pasty, fat, white. I don't know, man. These they're analysts. They're all analysts. Yeah. I don't know how many field agents there are, but they all try to make them. The movies, of course, anytime you see the CIA in a movie, it's always something super cool, and they're badass, and all the coolest technology and the smartest guys and really athletic. Probably the exact opposite.
Not fam. You're just a fat boomer analyst.
Yeah, you just see some frumpy woman with thin, greasy hair.
I doubt any of them are talking to serial killers asking about the screaming. What about the screaming, Dr. Lecter?
Yeah, did y'all ever see the pictures of Reality Winner, the NSA leaker, her vehicle? It was one of those Nissans with, like, the wraparound window and, like, tons of stickers all over it. The kind of person you see on the highway and just shake your head in disgust.
There's only two groups of people that cover their vehicles in bumper stickers, and that's schizophrenics and feds.
Yeah, there you go.
And people that live in Berkeley, so both.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Schizophrenic feds, yeah.
So, yeah, I've seen a million of them. But what else? Let's get back to the documentary real quick. The guys that wanted to, quote, blow the whistle. What do you think about these two guys coming forward and making this documentary that's, you know, been getting removed from YouTube and blah, 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 blah? You know, do you think they, quote, fear for their lives? Or, like, you know, they put their real names out there, and this is, like, you know,
this is real shit, right? This is always the struggle, because it's funny, because the opening of this really drives home. It's like, what information can you trust? And that's why I brought up these historical examples of that's why I brought up the example of Theodora's biographer, because her own biographer wrote three different contradicting reports about that. And so what am I supposed to take from that? How am I supposed to interpret that? And then you translate this kind of same problem to today and what we're talking about, the whole Michael Aquino problem. Is like, how much of this is real? How much of this is show? How much of this is smoke and mirrors? Because the best way to obscure the truth is to put a little bit of the truth out there, but mix it in with lies so that you can't tell which is which. You know, there's enough out there for you to, and then like, how much of this is meant to scare you in a certain sense by giving you a certain picture of what's happening, and how much of this are the people being allowed to do this? How much of this is malicious? It's almost impossible to entangle all of this stuff. And we know that there's problems with this documentary because they push the whole, you know, Operation Paperclip thing. You want to talk about operations? Forget Operation Paperclip. Let's talk about Operation Gladio. Like, they don't talk about that. They don't talk about the CIA, right. You know, CIA and the Mafia and Vatican connection, and the stay behind units, how they basically utilized the far right as a gay op against communist elements, playing both sides against each other in Europe. Like, no, we're not going to talk about that at all. But we're going to talk about, we'll just say, you know, Nazis were involved in everything. So how much, like, it's almost impossible to tell, like, how much of this, especially the misinformation in this, is intentional. How much of it, it's so hard to tell. Like, there's a smoke and mirror aspect to it, and I can't tell which is which at this time.
Right. That's what I was going to say, is how much of this is real and how much of it isn't. How much of it is them being kind of like boomer patriotards, where they actually believe that, you know what I mean, that the Nazis and Project Paperclip, and, you know, maybe Mike Smith actually believes that. I don't know. I'd have to sit down and talk to him, you know.
See, I'm an optimist, and I think that, like, say for the 1% of people that watch this and start looking deeper, you can only look into conspiracy stuff so much, first of all, before you find us, but second of all, before you become a Nazi yourself.
That was always one of the funniest things about the early days of all our podcasts, when I remember years back, Johnny talking about the amount of times that people would stumble up, like, you know, people who were into conspiracies, because, like, it's conspiracy itself is a cottage entertainment industry. The amount of people who stumbled upon his show because they wanted conspiracies, like, oh my God, these guys are Nazis.
Yeah,
that was great.
Like, these guys are right, but they're Nazis. Shit, the Cognis right now. Was there a mouse on the call? What just happened?
Yeah, I don't know what that was. It sounded like there was, like, a bird or something.
That was my daughter, sorry.
Oh, right on. Oh, that's that, in that case, that's awesome. I was going to say, I didn't realize Lawrence Murray's bird came back. But,
no, it's still in the cab with him.
Oh. At least he's got cab fare now.
Yeah, that was the greatest struggle. Yeah.
Oh. F. Big F. All right.
Anything else from this that you wanted to cover? I just had, like, a few scattering notes, but nothing that major.
There was one thing I thought was funny. When he was mentioning, Mike Smith was going over actors' names that were, like, quote, in on it and whatever. And he was like, Brad Pitt, Will Smith. Like, you could tell he just skipped over Tom Cruise. Like, he just didn't even want to say Tom Cruise's name.
Yes.
I thought that was funny. I thought it was kind of funny.
The Scientology, its relationship with Hollywood is interesting, because I've always been interested in kind of the power Scientology had, and didn't occur, like, it wasn't until somebody kind of pointed out that, you know, say what you will about it, and I do not think highly of Scientology or its practices, but there is a strong case to be made that it was used as to basically counter Jewish power in Hollywood by creating its own insane cult that had control over people's lives.
I definitely think that there was truth to that, and I think that that's not the only attempt, because if we bring it back to Michael Aquino...
Yes, I wanted to talk about Michael Aquino, so this is perfect.
Well, 6 years after, you know, he joined the Church of Satan because one of his professors that was one of the... I didn't write the guy's name down, but it was an Indian man that was one of the best... classical scholars, like the man, you know, knows more about, he's forgotten more about Plato than any of us will ever know. He was a theosophist and clearly kind of got that sort of thing into Aquino's ear. and that's what led him to checking out the Church of Satan. But as I was kind of stating, that is fake in terms of it's not a real philosophy. It's basically like libertarianism. There's nothing spoopy really going on in there.
It's basically libertarianism, but even more Jewish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so he started the Temple of Set, which he specifically says is to get around the Judeo-Christian. I hate saying that, but that's what he says. Get around that whole element of religion.
I think by the way, the name you were looking for was it Asbjorn Dyrendal? Oh no, like that sounds like a Nordic name. Never mind.
No, it was an Indian guy. It was some name I wouldn't be able to pronounce properly anyways. It's not too hard to find, but that's kind of what got him going down that path, is that, you know, Aquino's actually a pretty advanced scholar, and I'm sure that he just realized that what he was looking for wasn't in that. So he started an alternative, really. And the way I see it was to get away from the Jewish bullshit. So it's kind of like Scientology in that regard, where like these people are trying to set up cults to get away from that sort of thing.
So I guess then who, because this was a note I wrote down, because I was like, when we were watching this documentary, we were very perplexed by like, why would somebody like Michael Aquino, like, you know, you have the military allowing this guy to talk openly about his stuff. Why would they allow him to just go on Oprah? And I had written like the Nazi shit, and that connection just makes it seem like this is like one of many covers. This is part of the whole smokescreen aspect, the showmanship. Like a Michael Aquino is meant to be a distraction more than anything else, or at least present a certain image to you. That, and I don't know how much he's in on it. I don't know. I know you and I were kind of going back and forth a bit on this.
I think he's, I mean, he's got to know that he's the fool guy at this point. You know, he's the public face of the weirdness that is the Temple of Set, I guess, right? I mean, but he believes in, and isn't Satanism, but now Satanism is just like what, like edgy 14-year-old stuff.
Right, in Temple of Set, like, he doesn't bother correcting people when they call it Satanist, whatever. I think it's because he's too smart or autistic. Like, we don't bother always correcting people with their misnamings of us. You know, you just kind of move on and talk about whatever you wanted. Essentially, Temple of Set is a Platonist and Pythagorean philosophical order.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It really is tough to say how much he's involved with any of the abuse allegations, whereas we know other people that definitely are, and they escaped justice, and they're still out there, or recently suicided. So you have, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell out there running around terrorizing people, whereas Aquino was just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I will say that he's in an awful lot of wrong places at some really wrong times, but there really isn't too much to personally tie him to stuff.
Yeah, that was the most striking thing.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's just like that was the most striking thing to me. It's like he does, like it's he's always there, like as like this clown figure, and yeah, he probably knows stuff, but it's like, what does he actually do compared to the people who we know actually do things?
Right.
Well, one of his biggest things, and this is going to sound crazy, but he's actually kind of a peace activist. His one of his main books is called Mind War, and it's really about just kind of getting away from actual military conflicts and just making it a psychological thing only. And apparently he has distributed this book widely through the current high-ranking Trump administration, and it's been well received. He's still a well-respected guy. He did personally disavow the Clintons and say that he has nothing to do with them, which I found amazing. He does not want to tie himself to them. Like, he doesn't want to be associated in any way.
Are you saying he's like an esoteric optics cuck? Is this what's going on with this guy?
Well, I don't think that would be correct to say it that way.
I'm just making a joke, but
yeah. Yeah, no, well, I mean, you're kind of correct, though. Like, he just doesn't care about the optics. He's doing his own thing. It's, and this was just after doing some real deep dives on him since watching this, because I just had to know more.
Yeah, I can't wait for the upcoming Mitch Hoob and Michael Aquino interview.
I emailed him. I'm waiting for him to get back to me. Every time my email notification goes off, I jump because I'm scared.
Knowing Michael Aquino, he's just going to show up to your door for the interview.
Yeah.
It's going to be, he's going to have those eyebrows and that black hair.
Yeah. He's quit dying it.
Yeah. One, right? Those eyebrows, though, those things.
Yeah, and he's definitely an interesting character. He also wrote a fictional book about the scenario of a 1940 peace agreement that leads to the Nazis establishing the first European Union. So he's an interesting guy.
I don't know how to process that. But he ultimately could just be what we know, what we've learned about all these Department of Defense people. They're just giant nerds with powerful weapons.
That's what I think. I think he's just autistic.
See, that's fundamentally the only difference, I guess, between a lot of people. There's a lot of autistic nerds out there, and the only thing that separates them is, do they have power and weapons or not?
Yeah, if you notice in the first clip where they show him, you know, displaying his SS dagger in the movie, he's blinking way too much. And only two kinds of people blink way too much: creepy, disgusting Satanist pedos and autists.
This is true.
So I would ask the listener right now that's blinking too much, which one are you?
I got nothing else on this documentary. You guys have anything else you wanted to cover?
No, I was really good.
I was gonna say it's really good. I enjoyed it. From somebody who's seen pretty much every conspiracy documentary out there, this is one you're gonna definitely want to check out. This is when you can show your normie friends. This is when you can easily red pill people with this on this particular topic.
I do
have some friends who are anti Pizzagate. Show them this. You know, it's good. It's good.
Yeah, it's always good to review the basics. That's my biggest thing with recommending it to everybody.
Yeah, and I really liked how this thing, because we didn't really touch on it. It talks about Operation Mockingbird, which is something I always love to bring up. Always like to say, Operation Mockingbird never ended. And for those who are uninitiated, Operation Mockingbird was the CIA influencing news journalism. I mean, it's still going on to this day. You had John Brennan. You had the former CIA director it's so absurd when you think about this. Like, you have John Brennan on cable news. It's no different than having a former KGB chief on RT. There's no difference except that at least the Russians are honest about what they're doing.
They are honest. No, they're honest about what they're doing, because when they talked about the Podesta emails, he said they are honest. They said it's illegal for you to look at them. Only we can look at them. It was Chris Cuomo. And then before that, it was somebody was trying to form an opinion, and that's our job. Remember that?
Yeah, that was Mika, I believe.
Yeah,
Mika Brzezinski, the daughter of Zbigniew, whatever his name is, Brzezinski.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, yeah.
Yeah.
That guy, yeah. It's right there in your face. They slap you with their little circumcised little schmeckle right upside the head, and we say, thank you. Is there going to be another season?
Yeah, there's just so many lies you can't even begin to start picking them apart before they bombard you with more.
Yep. That's the thing. It's one of those things. It's just that during the headlights, you can't process all that stuff. So, you know, I don't know. It's just overload for people, and they don't get it. And it's glazed over deer in the headlights look, and they don't even care. They don't even think about it. Yeah. Show your friends, man. This is a good time.
Yeah. I want to stress this on the, like, when, if you ever hear anybody say that Operation Mockingbird, that was a temporary thing that ended. It's like, remember, John Brennan is on MSNBC. Mika Brzezinski is the daughter of Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Z Big Nigga.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah, and Brzezinski was like, he was a national security, NSA, he was a national security advisor. And as we learned, like, these organizations are not, like, formalized as, like, oh, like, I'm in this organization, and therefore, like, I, you know, like, I'm going to separate these aspects. No, like, these people form informal fraternities. So, you know, NSA, CIA, and there's no effective difference between the two.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
So. There's zero difference. It's like, what you put, look at these two pictures and tell me the difference with that Pam from The Office thing. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right,
you guys.
This was
I had
a good time. Yeah.
And you guys helped me plug the pause button gap since I've been working on Linkola stuff. So it was good to get another episode out before I work on the Prestige.
Oh yeah, man. Ooh, that's a good one. I like that movie.
Yep. I'm gonna have Titus and Apache on for that one.
Awesome. Yeah, well, this ties in really nicely with my little Laurel Canyon series and all the other stuff that we're doing. So this was good. I like the synchronicity of all this. It was nice. Thanks for having me on, and good to talk to you as always, there, Mr. Hoob.
Yep.
Thank you,
Johnny. Thank you, Hoob. And with that, I'm gonna push the spoopy button on this.
All right, later.
Time travel makes you gay.
Tôi là vô nghĩa. Về đi.